Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Brooks Holland, and I represent Vladimir Pejeda in this appeal before the court.
Pejeda.
With the court's permission, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Certainly.
Thank you. Your Honors, this appeal arises from a complex fraud prosecution here in the Western District that culminated in an 11-day jury trial with a large number of witnesses and different types of evidence that were relevant to the issues before the jury in this case. Despite all of the evidence from the prosecution and the defense about the nature of Mr. Pejeda's business, how it operated, representations that were made to promoter investors, how money was coming in and out of the business, and how and why the business ultimately folded and went into bankruptcy, the central issue for the jury when it retired to deliberate was criminal intent. The defense centered on Mr. Pejeda's position that even though he was running an entrepreneurial business that carried with it risks that parlayed initially into profit and good income, but that unfortunately ultimately resulted in a failed business that left people with significant losses, he did not intend to defraud anybody as part of that operation. In that frame of this case, that perspective takes me to a critical evidentiary error by the district court in ruling on the government's motion to admit background evidence in the government's position, but evidence that the government already had investigated and effectively accused Mr. Pejeda of running a Ponzi scheme, something that could be a criminal fraud, to the jury through the lead FBI agent, Agent Cote, C-O-T-E. He was permitted to testify that he received a referral for further investigation, not from somebody who phoned into the FBI with a complaint as a private civilian, but from the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC is not going to resonate with the jury as an informal and inexperienced source for this type of accusation. And the characterization that the district court permitted was that the SEC believed that Mr. Pejeda was running a Ponzi scheme.
Did you try this case?
No.
Okay. Did trial counsel object?
Yes, and moved to strike that testimony. It was litigated prior to trial as part of a limiting motion practice, along with the testimony of another witness, that I'll connect in a moment, a civilian
witness. Was
there
anything else said, but that's how the agent got the referral?
Your Honor, when you ask whether there was anything else said, are you talking about during Agent Cote's testimony or throughout the trial itself?
Yeah.
Agent Cote's testimony was connected later to another FBI agent who had worked with Agent Cote. I believe it appears in volume 6 of the excerpts in pages 1117, 1118.
My question is, was the jury told anything other than this was the agency that referred the case to the agent?
They were told that it was not just a referral, but it was a referral because the SEC had concluded that Mr. Pejeda was running what the agent characterized as a Ponzi scheme. And critical to the argument I briefed for the court is that the district court gave the jury no instructions whatsoever about how to receive and consider that evidence. They were not instructed that it should be background evidence taken for a non-hearsay purpose, that they should not consider it in
even after the objection?
Correct. Even after the objection, there was an objection. But
obviously, after we get all the way through this, and I've kind of remained pretty silent here, but we're really on the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, right?
I appreciate the standard review is abuse of discretion. So the court's
because it's abuse of discretion, we're really talking about determining whether the risk of the unfair prejudice in admitting the testimony doesn't substantially outweigh its probative value, right?
Correct.
So my worry about all of this, and you've given a good intro into it, is that my standard of review, and having sat on the district bench a couple of years in my old days, it's illogical, implausible, or without support. And I guess there is some probative value in what was done. I'm trying to weigh the risk of the prejudice. I think the probative value is pretty low, but my worry is the risk of prejudice is pretty low as well.
Well, Your Honor, if I may address both sides of point, the prejudice as well as the probative value. In my brief, I did not argue that there was no probative value.
I was going to say, right. If you go there, I read your brief.
Correct. But the circumstances presented the district court with so much opportunity to exercise discretion in how this evidence could be admitted for its limited probative value. And I would agree, and you saw in my brief, I argued the probative value was limited in this context. The district court could have allowed simply we received a referral for investigation or similar testimony that sanitized it of this official channel referral that necessarily would have prejudicial impact on the jury.
Well,
limiting instructions would have done wonders here for the jury to be able to
hear. But the problem comes, and I guess that's why I emphasized in my questioning what was the standard of review. The problem comes that it's such a high standard to overturn on appeal. I couldn't find a case that was dead on that would have said it ought to be overturned. So then I tried to say, would it be illogical, implausible, or without support? No. And frankly, I didn't think either one were very high in either the probative value or the prejudice. So I thought, well, I don't know how I can get over on abuse of discretion. That's why I'm asking you the question in that way.
I appreciate that question, Your Honor. And I think what I would suggest is that what we see here is in the evidence, not just this evidence in isolation, as prejudicial as I would argue it is, as official channel accusation of a Ponzi scheme, but the layering and priming that happened with another witness who had testified the day earlier, one of the early civilian witnesses.
And then coupling, you're going to try to couple it with the victim then?
Correct, who testified that he had a prior experience with Mr. Pujita, where Mr. Pujita had effectively scammed him out of $50,000.
And then he reinvested.
And he reinvested because of the conversation to which he testified.
But counsel, if you go beyond, I think I'm not so sure I would have made this same ruling. It's abuse of discretion standard. We know we sometimes disagree. Maybe Judge Smith and I would have disagreed as trial court judges on that evidentiary ruling. That would not be the first time that's ever happened. But if you're going to look broader, I think that's where your client loses this argument. Even if I agree with you that maybe the prejudicial nature of that evidence outweighed the probative value, there's still a lot of evidence. And so why would we find that this is not harmless error if we decided it was error?
Yes, I understand, Your Honor. And I think you're highlighting in this kind of context how prejudice on the substantive question can really relate a lot to harmless error questions as well.
Well, I'm just saying, I think Judge Smith raises really good questions about harmless error, about the abuse of discretion standard. It is a very high standard. I guess what I'm trying to say is even if you get past that, I think your client has problems here trying to convince at least me, maybe not my colleagues, I don't know, that this was harmless in the context of the overall trial.
One of the critical aspects of the trial in the defense was that the defense, and the government makes this point in its brief as support for its position, is that the defense highlighted how other people through social media and Google had lodged complaints about the business, that Mr. Pujita was running effectively a scam type of business. And Mr. Pujita used this evidence of trial as part of his defense to show how and why he conducted the business the way it did and why it lost money and failed ultimately. And the government argues that the testimony is simply redundant, therefore, to the defense case. But I would argue that it further undermined the defense case because the defense is taking the position that random people on Google or other social media sites, the haters, are coming after my business to undermine it by raising complaints, something we see all the time, and we have to evaluate whether these are legitimate complaints or not. He was arguing they were not. When the jury was primed from the beginning of the case to hear that he had already scammed one of the victims and owed him $50,000, and that we had an official channel report from the Securities and Exchange Commission that he was running a Ponzi scheme with no clarification of when, why, or how that Ponzi scheme existed, it totally undercut key defense evidence about how and why this business failed in a way that was consistent with his defense at trial, that he lacked fraudulent intent.
Couldn't have had anything to do with the amount of money that he and his partner took out, right?
And
how much they disclosed to the bankruptcy court.
That's certainly the government's position.
There's a pretty big gap, isn't there?
There is a big gap, and I would suggest, Your Honor, with your question, that it actually reinforces another concern that I raised in the opening brief about how the original fraud against the civilian investor promoters in counts 2 through 22 effectively were a separate agreement from the alleged fraud in the bankruptcy system to which Your Honor appears to be referring. And in the brief, I reinforced the argument that had been presented to the district court that the single conspiracy count in count one, therefore, was potentially at least duplicitous in covering two separate agreements with the span of criminal objects that were charged as substantive offenses. And on appeal, I didn't challenge whether the district court should have dismissed that count outright, as was part of the motion before the district court, but that the district court, again, abused its discretion in not instructing the jury, as the defense specifically requested, to call that question to the jury's attention. Conspiracy charges, particularly in a case like this one, with 27 counts spanning months, if not years, of alleged misconduct, fraud to civilian investors, fraud to the bankruptcy system, conspiracy charges are enormously complex. And the instruction would have clarified for the jury its task of determining whether this offense comprised one conspiracy relating to the whole span of offenses, as the government argued, or two agreements, an agreement to defraud the investor promoters, comprising counts 2 through 22, and then a subsequently formed agreement to defraud the banking system with the alleged conduct to which Your
but
Honor.
You think here, oh, please.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I was going to say, but here we could go with what Judge Christin was asking you about, because, he was convicted of every count. So now we're at harmless error.
That is the government's position.
Well, that's not the government's position. That's our position in Hernandez-Escarraga. I can't even say it because I'm from Idaho. Escarraga. The 886 Fed Second, that's their position too. And I can't get around that. I'm only a three-judge panel. Even if error, they say, since they're convicted of every count, it's harmless error.
Well, I would argue it's not harmless error here, notwithstanding. Well,
why not?
Because the district court also gave the jury an unmodified Pinkerton instruction. And Pinkerton allows the jury to convict on every substantive offense if they find that those substantive offenses, even if they weren't the objects of the conspiracy itself, were reasonably foreseeable crimes committed by somebody who was a participant of the conspiracy. And because the district court did not instruct the jury the way the defense requested, Pinkerton just throws a substantive conviction blanket over all the offenses, and we cannot infer from the jury's verdict, because they convicted of all of these offenses, that the jury necessarily made the correct findings regarding the nature and scope of the conspiracy. It could have had a non-unanimous verdict on the conspiracy, but everybody agreed that every offense was a reasonably foreseeable crime committed in furtherance of the conspiracy under Pinkerton. And so I connected the Pinkerton instruction, not because that instruction was erroneous standing alone, but because in context, it further reinforced the confusion that the jury would experience.
Did you want to save some time?
I did. If I could,
sure.
Even though I'm eating a little bit into rebuttal, I did want to add one point on the false statement, false declaration issue I raised under the new Supreme Court case Thompson. And I wanted to highlight one option for the court in dealing with it. If the court concludes, as we argued, that it raises a question of whether that statement to the bankruptcy trustee was false in the way Thompson now requires. The Seventh Circuit in Thompson just decided that case on remand from the Supreme Court on July 24th, about 10 days ago, and concluded that it should not decide this issue in the first instance with appellate briefing, and instead remanded the case to the district court for the district court to make findings and conclusions of law in the first instance on remand from Thompson. So I would ask the court to consider that disposition as part of the available dispositions here. I see I have 1 minute left for rebuttal. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You bet. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Philip Kopczynski for the United States. Mr. Pegida was convicted of 26 felonies based on overwhelming evidence that Trend Sound Promoter, that's his company, that it was a Ponzi scheme. It was intentionally so, and that he lied to the bankruptcy court. He fled across the country before he could face sentencing, And the district court rightly denied the reduction for acceptance of responsibility. On the question...
On that point, isn't it correct that even if the district court had accepted the acceptance of responsibility, the sentence would have still been within the range?
Yes, I believe that's right.
So it's harmless?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. And I believe... The court could come at it from many directions, but another possible direction is that, of course, a defendant who flees to Florida is on the run for multiple months, is literally extracted out of a wall to be arrested, that person has not genuinely manifested contrition for his actions. The point just being discussed with the court, I'd like to briefly touch on. We don't think there was any possibility that this juror was less than unanimous on the objects of the conspiracy, and that's because the district court gave a specific unanimity instruction. It is embedded within the conspiracy instruction as part of the model. So really here, what the defense, I guess, would have wanted is some sort of supplement that said the same thing again. And there's simply no precedent from this court that says a district judge has to sort of say something twice in instructions.
But what about his argument that this was really two different conspiracies and maybe they were unanimous as to one and not the other? Maybe they all agreed that there was that they didn't think very highly of his conduct vis-a-vis the bankruptcy court, because that's pretty cut and dried. The assets weren't disclosed on the schedules when the bankruptcy was commenced. I think that's the theory, that they could have gone with one conspiracy, not the other.
If the jurors were unanimous as to a object of the conspiracy, they appropriately voted guilty. Even if, and I don't think this is the case for the other reasons, there are other verdicts, but even if we sort of hypothetically supposed that as to count one, they were only thinking of the bankruptcy, for example, I think that's still a valid guilty verdict,
right?
Because they've unanimously agreed that that was an object of the conspiracy as charged.
Was there an argument on the – would the transcript show that there was an argument that there really needed to be two different instructions because the jury could disagree about whether there was an intent to defraud the bankruptcy court separate from the primary thrust of the defense, which is that he didn't intend for his investors to be defrauded? And his business simply failed. Was that hashed out in the trial court?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor. And I don't know that even the defense's sort of proposed instruction directly addressing the question of specific unanimity would have gotten to that kind of level of detail, the element of intent versus some other element. But instead, just as the district court in fact did instruct here, it would have urged the jurors to be unanimous on the object. I believe that's the language.
Well, sort of the gist of it, the flavor, I guess I would say, that comes through in the briefing as it is. Wife is the person who was fluent in one language, and she dealt primarily with the bankruptcy court, and he dealt primarily with the investors. And so there's this idea that there's really two different things going on, two different conspiracies. And perhaps the jury could have agreed and been unanimous as to the one, but not to the other. And I can't tell, frankly, from your briefing, the extent to which you think that is waived, or whether you're really just relying on, you think this wouldn't matter anyway.
So I think exactly the argument that Your Honor is articulating now is not one I've heard from the defense, so I do think that would be waived. But I also, I want to address the sort of factual premise of that, because I think it's wrong, and I think the district court saw it was wrong. Mm-hmm. It is true Mr. Pegita spoke less English than his co-defendant. That's true. But the facts clearly showed him in the lead at all phases of the conspiracy.
Well, it is something that goes unanswered in the briefing. I couldn't figure out, does that mean he's only his investors are all speaking his native language? They're not speaking English? Or was that the idea?
I think the evidence showed that there was a mix, sometimes in English, sometimes in other languages. I think there wasn't probably too much testimony even about that, because I think there was never a claim from Mr. Pegita that he just like flat out didn't understand something. Certainly he did try to advance, I think, during trial, just as he has on appeal, this idea that Ms. Bondarenko, the co-defendant, was the sort of more fluent English speaker.
But
well, and that she was responsible for dealing with the bankruptcy court. She was responsible for the, she's the reason, I guess, that the very large asset that we're talking about, I think that money was extracted prior to filing bankruptcy, a home was purchased, that's not in the bankruptcy schedules, right?
And that's
I think,
right.
I think the
that's right.
I think the defense was that that was on her.
Well, and see, that's just, I think that's completely inconsistent with the evidence. So, for example, Mr. Pegida was subject to the kind of deposition that it's a standard process taken by the trustee in the bankruptcy. Mr. Pegida, not Ms. Bondarenko.
Did the jury hear
The jury
that?
Heard
in, yes.
audio clips from that proceeding, I believe about five of them. I was trial counsel, and we, I think we had about five or six clips from that proceeding, him in his own voice. Giving some of the key lies about there's all these investors and other things backing the company, some of the very same key lies that he had given to the promoter victims. So we think that's one aspect of many that shows actually the evidence established a single conspiracy. This was not something the jury would have struggled with. And even if there could have been some room, we actually do think the record, as the district court saw, leaves this as at most harmless because the jury was convicting across the board, the full slate. If I could briefly also touch on the evidentiary questions, I think the main thing I'd like to do is just direct the court to precisely what actually came into evidence, because I do think it matters here. If we look at 4 ER 631, that's Agent Cote's testimony that the defense now challenges. The single sentence that the defense says is so prejudicial as to require reversal. And what the agent said after the objection and then the sentence he sort of is able to complete is, we had received a referral from the Securities and Exchange Commission alleging that TrendSound Promoter might be a Ponzi scheme or a fraud scheme. So if you actually parse those words, right, what is that really saying? Is that hearsay even? Is that an assertion? I think the sort of conditional nature of that language, and that's it, by the way. It goes on from there. There was an objection. The district court overruled it. But that's it. There was no more discussion about this. There was not a question, for example, what is the Securities and Exchange Commission? None of that. The questioning moved on. And so that idea might be, not as my colleague on the other side said a moment ago, that the SEC had concluded already by the time they're giving this to FBI that this is a Ponzi. No. Might be a referral.
But the worry that I have, and I guess this is the question I had for you, it didn't seem to me that the district court did anything except determine, without giving any explanation, about the probative value substantially outweighing the risk of unfair prejudice. So because the district court didn't say anything about it, they just ruled on the objection, am I stuck with a different standard of review?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think...
Why?
Well, for two reasons. First is, of course, this is happening with the jury present, mid-trial, right? This isn't a motion in limine or some other setting where the district court might have more of an opportunity to develop its reasoning. And I think in that setting, just as counsel is limited to sort of to limit speaking objections and so forth, I think the district court can appropriately make a ruling without pausing to explain its reasoning. And I think this court should presume the court, the district court, went through the proper analysis.
Well, but there's no question that if the district court failed to engage in a proper 403 balancing, I would have to do it de novo, wouldn't I?
What I'm really looking at is
I have to make this determination. And in general, it's an abuse of discretion determination. And in general, when I had it in front of me in the district court, I said, well, I think it's probative, but the risk is too much. Or I said it's probative and the risk isn't enough. And I had that right on the record so that I didn't have any question about whether it was a discretionary decision or not. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, what do I do in this instance where the district court didn't say anything?
Well, I think you presume the district court applied the relevant rules of evidence and reach that conclusion just without saying so in front of the jury. Because I think in my experience, it would be unusual for the judge with the jury present to say something, for example, like, I think this evidence has probative value, or that sort of reasoning from the court is just not typically, I think, something a judge would want
to
express.
Well, then what do? I just look at the record?
Right. I think this court would apply standard abuse of discretion review, looking at the record, and decide if the court made the right call on 403, for example, but without sort of thinking maybe the district court somehow like forgot to apply 403. I think the other related piece of this is I think this was actually an easy call for the district court. I think Judge Martinez at this point was well aware that this idea, this complaint about Trendsound Promoter, was a key feature of this case. It's why, for example, in the post-trial setting, the defense went so far as to claim their trial counsel was ineffective, constitutionally ineffective, for not talking about this very issue more. Both sides, the defense maybe more so than the government, wanted to talk about this, because from the defense's perspective, this was exculpatory. People were calling Trendsound Promoter a Ponzi scheme. That sort of defamation brought down the company before it could flourish. That was a key defense theory. And on our side, for example, Agent Cote, this sort of testimony, this one line I just read, queued up other key events in the timeline. For example, at 4 ER 656, Agent Cote went on to describe meeting with the defendant and the co-defendant, where he confronted them. His testimony was, I told them being Mr. Pegita, Ms. Bondarico, that we had received allegations or complaints that TSP was a scam. That was a pivotal moment in the story. He confronts them, and then they give a kind of false story in the government's view. That's how we presented it at trial. They gave their response to those allegations was this false story. So both sides were talking about this constantly. I think Judge Martinez knew that, and I think that's why in the moment hearing this single line about the scam allegation, he easily saw that was not a proper objection that should be sustained. Unless the court has other questions, we ask.
It doesn't appear that we do have other questions. Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few quick points in response to my colleague's arguments. I wanted to highlight the challenged evidence here. The government is working hard to weave it into its narrative and story about this alleged fraud by connecting it to the interview by the agent with my client and evidence introduced or explored by my client about other people making these allegations. But really what we're talking about here is an official channel accusation from the Securities and Exchange Commission that went to the ultimate issue for the jury before they had heard most of the evidence.
Did the jury hear anything about official channel allegation? It sounds like it was a really brief mention. And I appreciate your point is that if the jury heard that the SEC was concerned about this, they might put sort of more weight in that. You know, my immediate reaction is that I'm not so sure the jury would know what the SEC is. So,
but I believe
from what is it that should cause me to think that the jury would really sit up and be concerned?
From the very testimony my colleague read, the agent spelled out Securities and Exchange Commission to the jury. And then that connected to testimony they had already heard from one of the investors who alleged a prior bad act of the same kind of conduct.
The one who reinvested.
And then reinvested, correct. And so early in the trial, the jury is already being primed that eyes are on Mr. Pegita as a scammer before they really get into this whole narrative and his theory of the defense.
Right. Counsel,
I did want to highlight one place.
You're over time, so please wrap up.
Sure. One place in the record, Your Honor, you were asking about with the unanimity instruction, whether this had been fleshed out in front of the district court. I wanted to invite the court to look in volume one. I believe it's page 118. It was a hearing the court held by Zoom prior to delivering its order on this issue, where I think these arguments were fleshed out very much. Thank you much, very much, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take that case under submission and go to the next case on the oral argument calendar.